Well, thank you very much for the interview, Eric. Appreciate it.
Sure.
And no, you really brought out an interesting thing, something you sent about how really linking the sequestration to reductions in research and development on an environmental scale. That was a very interesting thing. What obviously the sequestration brought it on, but what focus, what brought on that focus for you?
Well, my research institute, the Woods Hole Research Center, is a group here in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, where we focus on scientific research related to managing the environment, managing the resources of forests, water, soils. We study impacts of climate change on how ecosystems work, including agriculture, forestry, and we believe that science plays a crucial role to finding the solutions to how we can meet the demands of a growing population for food, for sustenance, for all the things that we take for granted as part of our prosperous livelihoods. It comes from the way that we manage our natural resources and how cleverly we do that. And that requires investment, long-term investment in science and education. These are issues that aren't going to be solved in the short term. They're not going to be solved probably in my generation. So we need to be investing in the science now and the education and training the next generation of scientists. And unfortunately, that's the very type of thing that is being cut by sequestration, is investment in research and in education. And I think it's a very short-sighted thing for the nation and for humanity as a whole.
What sort of numbers are we talking about in terms of what is spent right now by the government? And is it that 10% cut? What are they talking about for that?
Well, you know, it sounds like a relatively innocuous number when you're talking about, 8% or 5% cut. It sounds like, that's just a little bit of cut at the margin. But in fact, it's really the money at the margin that really makes a big difference, and you see it in terms of all through various sectors, of whether it's cutting Head Start classes for preschool, or whether it's simply reducing the total number of research grants that the National Science Foundation or the NASA or Department of Energy awards. It's really that little bit on, not a little bit, it actually comes out to be a large number when you look at it in dollars and cents, but in terms of percentages, it sounds like it's a relatively small number at the margin, but it really does make a big impact on what is available to invest in research and education.
Yes, an interesting point. Obviously, usually America is the leader in that type of thing. How is the rest of the world looking at what you're looking at? Are there governments and other organizations doing similar things, or is America really pulling the weight for the world in this?
Well, we've been a leader for quite a long time, certainly since Sputnik and maybe even since World War II, in research in all sorts of areas of science. I think we are losing that edge to some degree. We certainly are still the leaders if you look in terms of, metrics like numbers of papers published or PhDs produced or things like that. But I do believe that we are losing an edge. I think, for instance, in investment in renewable sources of energy, I think we're seeing a lot of advances in China, for example, because of investments that they make. I do a lot of work, field work in Brazil. I've done work in studying the Amazon forest and the savanna that they call the Cerrado there. And I see, even though Brazil is a much poorer country than the United States, they've put tremendous amount of effort and investment in their university system and in their agricultural research service, for example, And it's paying off. I can even see it in just working there in a couple of decades, seeing how their capacity to manage their resources, whether it's water resources and rivers or the forest or their agriculture, their capacity has grown and it's paying off, and the country is becoming more prosperous and people are better off. And so I really do believe in the notion that investment in our people and in our educational system does pay off the society in the long term.
Well, that's a very good point. And obviously, the cutting Head Start, all those other educational programs, that's going to lead to fewer scientists, just that whole domino effect, really, isn't it, that reduces even more?
Well, you have to look at every stage in the pipeline. Just today, we had a group of undergraduate students here on our campus learning about how to measure trees and measure how much biomass, how much carbon they store, and these are students from it's a program here for advancing minority students in areas of science where they are normally underrepresented. Fortunately, this program has not been cut, but it's one that's funded by NOAA, and it's one that my colleagues from NOAA say that they're quite worried about. And these students are getting once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to come to a community like Woods Hole, which is known for its scientific excellence, several different institutions here, and to see role models and see possibilities of what they can do. And talking to the students today at lunch, I realized that even though they come from a different socioeconomic background than I came from, they're motivated by the same things that I was motivated when I was a student. They love the pursuit of knowledge. They're curious. This particular group likes to be outdoors and work in environmental sciences. And it's a great opportunity for them to develop their interests and skills. But then they also will need, once they finish their undergraduate degrees, they'll need to get graduate degrees, and they'll need to move on through their career program, and they'll need to be investments for them to be able to prosper and you put their skills to good use for the benefit of society. And so it's important that we invest in all areas of the pipeline, from preschool up through graduate school and beyond.
A cheap investment, basically.
Well, in terms of payback to the economy as well, back when they were debating a few years ago about stimulus and what's the best way of, funding shovel-ready projects, it always occurred to me that the best way is to make sure the money gets spent is to support students, because, students aren't putting it underneath their mattresses and they're not socking it away in a savings account. They're barely making ends meet at the end of each month. And so what we invest in education and students goes right back into the economy and feeds the economy at all levels.
Well, that's it. And especially nowadays, obviously, with the internet, we're talking about a different world where, 9-year-olds are getting involved. I know I speak to many people with different organizations, and they're amazed at, the youth that are really coming forward, because they can now. How do you find that on that side of things?
We're doing research here in an international scale, and we involved graduate students and undergraduate students, and we do have students from our local schools coming here and being involved. And we also noticed that on our website, there is a seasonal pattern on our website that when the school sessions are on, we get lots more hits about our science, and we're convinced, and it also seems to come in cycles with holiday vacations, it drops, and it seems to increase when you might be expecting term papers do and things like that, or science projects do. It's quite clear that there are students all across the country that are accessing our work, and we try to translate our work. We don't just publish in the highfalutin peer-reviewed scientific journals. We do that, of course. That's very important. But we also try to translate that science, especially on our website, to other audiences, including students at all levels. I had an opportunity a couple of years ago to advise a group that was working with the Girl Scouts on how to... they don't call it a badge anymore. I'm afraid I've forgotten what it is. But a project that they can do to earn credit. And this was designed to provide the Girl Scouts with a project for understanding where our energy comes from, where the electricity comes from, and what its impacts are on the environment in terms of, air pollution, climate change. It was very innovative in the way that they put together programs that are accessible to the girls on websites to understand those things and bring it down to their everyday life and things like what it means to leave their cell phone adapter plugged in when they're not using it and the extra juice that it uses up and things like that that really can be meaningful and understand what the actions that we take and decisions we make every day have impacts.
In fact, I'm just pulling out my adapter from the wall.
Sorry, I didn't want to make you feel guilty. Actually, I mean, that is a little tiny minor thing, but in fact, actually, you folks out there in California have been really at the forefront in terms of calculating how the state can lower its energy demands, and this thing that they call, I believe they refer to it as, vampire users of energy, these things like... you have a clicker on your TV and all sorts of things that are constantly using energy because they have to be connected for the very next time somebody's going to use them. That is a, that's a technological thing so that those could be addressed technologically and so that less energy is used in that way. But again, that's another thing that requires, in this case, it's kind of applied research, but it's the many ways that research pays off in terms of bringing back to us improvements in our lifestyles.
Well, that's it. I mean, really, that brings up obviously global warming with the sequestration. Is it a chance for them to put it on the back burner? Just cut the programs that don't monitor it and things like this? Is something like that going to happen?
Well, there is certainly another agenda in certain elements in Congress to try to defund the Environmental Protection Agency and to try to defund the Department of Energy from regulating carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases and investing in renewables. Mm. Now, whether the sequestration is being used as a mechanism to achieve that other goal, I suppose it probably is, although, I'm not involved in the trenches and in the politics of what's going on in Washington as to the various strategies. But, yes, certainly in the name of cost-cutting, I've seen the justification, supposedly, for defunding much of what the Environmental Protection Agency is trying to do to regulate greenhouse gases. And I think that's a very short-sighted sort of thing because the price of food is going to go up, the price of water is going to go up as it becomes more and more difficult to produce the resources that we need in a more and more challenging environment. Variability in weather is something that farmers absolutely hate. They want more predictable weather. Well, we can't have totally predictable weather, but it's becoming less and less predictable as a result of climate change. And that will have impacts on our quality of life.
You brought up Brazil. How did they manage to get through the bureaucracy and the corporations, the multinationals, to achieve those goals? And how can that be applied here? Or is it so entrenched here that it's almost an impossibility?
Well, Brazil has, you know, it has its own challenges in civil society. There certainly are diverse stakeholders. There are multinational corporations. There are wealthy landowners. There are poor, small-scale landowners. There's tremendous diversity. But what I find really interesting about the Brazilian society is the way that there is an open dialogue. Sure, there are they have political parties and there are differences, but there is more dialogue across them, as far as I can see, than the kind of polarization that we're experiencing in our country right now. You know, it used to be that support for research in particular, for science in particular, was a very bipartisan support, you know, back in the days of following Sputnik, I'm referring to the Russian launching of a, or the Soviet launching of a rocket back in the late 50s and early 60s when just the space race was just beginning. The response to that was not partisan in any way. It was very a bipartisan support for investment in science. The same is true thinking back to Presidents Johnson and Nixon, you know, both parties are talking about investing in, you know, the war against cancer and so forth. It's only recently that it seems that there's a polarization among the parties of what kind of science is politically acceptable to invest in and what kind of science is not. And so, you know, for one party, the majority of one party anyway, not entirely, there's some exceptions, investing in environmental science is not a popular thing.
So, yes.
But in fact, if we want to get political, the historically, the two presidents that have been, you know, most historians consider the most environmentally friendly presidents are both Republicans. Teddy Roosevelt and Richard Nixon. And that may come as a bit of a surprise, but most of the environmental legislation and even the formation of the Environmental Protection Agency itself, most of modern environmental legislation was passed under the Nixon administration, under bipartisan support.
Wow.
And investment in science. There's a huge expansion investment of the environmental sciences, understanding how important natural resources are to our economy and our well-being throughout that time.
Yeah, and I suppose that must have helped really the creation of even of your work in terms of the work you do, that overall, you know, a lot of you, what you do, really, you go from very granular feet on the ground to really an amazing overview with your center. I'm very impressed in terms of looking at the, you know, the carbon cycles right down to going into villages. That's quite a range to do, but you're, I mean, it needs to be done, obviously, to connect all the dots. Is that why you do it?
Right. Well, I mean, we have people here, scientists who specialize in using satellites that orbit the Earth, that are studying the Earth and the way the Earth is changing, the forests, the rate at which forests are being cut, or in other places, the rate at which they're regrowing, the way they are responding to climate change, particularly in the Arctic, where climate is changing most rapidly. But in order to understand what's going on, you can't just simply sit in your desk and stare at a computer screen and see these wonderful data that come from streaming down from the satellites. You really have to get dirty and get on the ground. If you're studying the forest, you have to get out there in amongst all the bugs and so forth. And if you're studying the rivers, you have to get out there and get wet.
Yeah.
Because that's how you really do what we call ground truthing and understanding what it is that's going on. So we like to think of having both eyes in the sky and boots on the ground, and then you bring all the data back into the office and you think inside your tank there. We try to do all of those things. And it is kind of a unique approach that integrates a lot of different disciplines, from, you know, people that study forests and rivers and hydrology and economics, to try to get the whole picture together, because humans are a big part of every ecosystem now as well. Really isn't any place on Earth that isn't being impacted by humans in some way, so we have to make them as part of the study.
Do you work on specific things that happen rather than just the overall? I'm just saying, say, like, out your way, the wind generators, that big storm of protest, having wind generators in the ocean off of the coast.
Right.
And then just a few days ago, I read about the new fishing laws that are impacting New England because of overfishing brought down by NOAA. How do you work on those specific type of projects, or do you?
Well, here at the Woods Hole Research Center, we try to walk the walk as well as talk the talk, so that here on our campus, we have a energy-efficient building, reduce our plug loads. We have a wind turbine on our property as well as solar panels. So we produce more than half of the energy that we consume, and we don't burn any fossil fuels on site. So we're trying to lead by example. We also have our own wastewater treatment system so that we're not feeding as much nitrogen into the groundwater and into the estuaries where there are algal blooms. So we try to demonstrate through our own efforts that you can be cognizant of your own footprint while you're also doing your everyday work. We have supported the Cape Wind project, and we are organizing a conference for this coming autumn for the Cape and Islands, the Cape Cod and Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket, that is going to be focusing on both energy and energy self-sufficiency, to talk about how this area can become energy self-sufficient, and also on the impacts of climate change and preparedness. So, you know, we're lucky that, unfortunately, the folks in New York and New Jersey got all the brunt of the burden of Hurricane Sandy. It could very easily have, instead of taking a left turn at the New Jersey Turnpike, come up here to Cape Cod, right, and we could have been the ones that were damaged. And if we've looked at a 13-foot storm surge, which is what they experienced in New Jersey and New York, 13 feet of a storm surge, and we've mapped that out in the local area. What are the areas that would be inundated? What are the areas that first responders would have trouble getting to? And those are the kinds of things we're going to be discussing at this conference, so that people here are sensitized to what isn't just an imaginary. I mean, it happened just 500 miles south of us or 300 right. miles south of us.
Right.
And the next time it might very well happen here. You know, this is a way, and we can bring that science to the public by demonstrating with maps, with imagery showing what the scenarios are. And it's a very powerful tool that you can use for, you know, taking the science to the people.
I love maps myself. I'm a total map junkie.
Oh, yeah. Everybody loves to look at a map and look at where they live and where they went for a holiday and where Grandpa lives and so forth. It's a great tool.
Out here on the West Coast, obviously a big concern, I don't know if you're monitoring it, is the resultant plume from Fukushima. Are you watching that, how that's working in the hydrological cycle?
Well, I'd say two things about that. First, some of my colleagues down at our neighbor institution down the road here at another institution called the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, I imagine some people out in the West Coast probably know more about it than know about my institute, which is called the Woods Hole Research Center.
Right.
But the Oceanographic Institute is indeed, their scientists are indeed following the currents, how the currents have brought radioactive material from Fukushima to North America. Their focus is the oceans, and so it's appropriate that they are doing that. But one of the things that our scientists have worked on is related to that in terms of transport of airborne material from Asia over to, for instance, the glaciers in southeast Alaska. And by analyzing the soot that you find on the glacier, sometimes you find, you know, instead of it being a nice pristine white ice field, there's a lot of of black soot on it, and analyzing that, we can determine that a great deal of that comes from Asia, largely because of lax air pollution laws there and burning a lot of coal. And I imagine also there would be, if there's airborne radioactive fallout, it would be carried as well. But really our focus there on the glaciers has been how this soot, in turn, because it's dark, it's black, it absorbs the sun's energy, and it hastens the melting of the glaciers. So it's kind of a double whammy. In addition to there being climate change, especially rapid at high latitudes, there's also this soot that is making the glaciers warm up and melt even faster. Wow. So looking at transport from one continent to the next is very important in every way, from the ocean currents, the air jetties, commodity trading. What we're studying in Brazil in terms of expansion of agriculture to produce soybeans, well, why are they producing more soybeans in Brazil and cutting down forests to do so? It's because the Chinese are eating more meat and they need soybeans to feed the animals. So it's a small world.
How can people help? I mean, obviously, they should contribute to your group, Woodsole Research Center, but where should they go? And also, who should they be speaking to and writing to make a difference?
Well, everybody finds his or her own way to make a difference, whether it's whether you're a letter writer and like to write your congressperson, or whether you're an organizer with the scouts or your local church or whatever it is. I've talked to some of our supporters who are very active in their local community groups, whether it's church groups or business groups, in getting them to think about investing in renewable resources for their buildings, or making their buildings more energy tight, or whatever it is. So there are things that everybody can do in their own backyard, whether it's money, donating money, or being active in your local community in energy-related things. Also, we all make decisions every single day in our diets, what we eat. And I'm not suggesting that everybody becomes a vegetarian. I'm not a vegetarian. But the moderating the frequency and amount of meat, instead of being supersized all the time, that actually has a big impact on energy and nutrient pollution. It goes beyond simply, whether you get whether you use paper or plastic for your groceries at the grocery store, and whether or not you put out your recycling dutifully. Those are important things too. But I guess I would challenge people to think a little deeper about their lifestyles, where they're using energy, what kind of food they're consuming, how they can be more active in the community regarding thinking about the impacts of the decisions that they make and the organizations that they belong to, the workplace and the organizations they belong to on an everyday basis.
So if they want to contact you, what's the best way to contact the research center?
Well, of course, we're on the web, which is, it's simply whrc.org, www.whrc.org. That stands for Woods Hole Research Center. And right there, they can find information about all the different projects we're doing in the Arctic and the tropics in the U.S. There's ways of contacting us there, even if donating money if people wanted to do that. But it really is seriously a good resource for information about how the world is changing, how it's changing very rapidly, and how science is really needed, investments in science are needed to find a way to a more sustainable path.
Mm-hmm. You, as the president and the chief scientist for this group, you really have a very broad, view of that, I imagine, in terms of globally. And I think I read that's your specialties was the various cycles, I believe. So you know, the way things are going, as a last question, in five years, if things are going as they are and the sequestration stays as it is, where do you see we are, you know, the good, bad and the ugly?
Well, boy, I sure hope we turn around sequestration before 5 years. Obviously, the country has to deal with financial issues in the long term in many ways, but I hope that our leaders see the value in investing in science and education at all levels. I guess I don't want to go down the path of imagining where we'll be if they don't do that. I'd rather be more optimistic and say that they just are going to have to do that, and that we're going to have to demand that of our leaders. You know, I noticed that California, so many ways California leads the country, and I noticed that recently California, after retracting a great deal in terms of its budget and a lot of hardships in the university system. I used to be a postdoc at Berkeley, so I know a lot of people out there still and suffering cutbacks and furloughs and so forth. And now your state has a budget surplus, and you're trying to figure out the best way to deal with that, the best way to invest it or spend it or save it for a rainy day. But I hope that in somewhere in that calculus includes an investment in back into education and science. And then California will be once again setting an example for the rest of the country to follow.
Well, indeed. Thank you very much. Yeah, that we know where we need to go.
Right.
We've seen it.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, Eric. I really appreciate the interview. Fascinating. And good luck with your work.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good talking to you. Bye-bye.
Pleasure. Thank you. Bye.